Welcome back to the program. When Congressman Joe Wilson stood up during President Obama's speech and said, "You lie," he could have been talking about all of us. Well, we are told to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We seldom do. From corruption in our government to test score scandals, from elected leaders' extramarital affairs to the Ponzi schemes undermining our economy, cheating and dishonesty are ubiquitous parts of our culture and inescapable parts of the human condition. That's at least the finding of our guest today, Dan Ariely. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. He's run experiments with some 30,000 people and found that very few people lie a lot, but almost everyone lies a little. All of this is described in his new book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan Ariely, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure. Nice to be back.
Thanks so much for joining us. One of the things you talk about early on is this notion that cheating has always been sort of perceived as a cost-benefit analysis, that lying, that doing things like that, we analyze what the risk is, what the chances are of getting caught, what the punishment might be, and make a decision based on that.
That's at least the common perception, right? That's the model that we have, both as individuals as well as the government, right? And if you think that this is the reason people are honest or dishonest, then the solutions, the remedies are quite clear. For example, just have large prison sentences. And if the prison sentences are larger, then people would be less dishonest, or maybe not dishonest at all. But the reality is that this model, while sensible and appealing, is not accurate. It doesn't describe the real reasons why people are dishonest, or at least it doesn't describe the majority of dishonesty. And because of that, I think that most of our efforts to curb dishonesty are actually misapplied and ineffective.
Where does the model go awry?
So the model goes awry, first of all, by the fact that people don't really consider long-term ramification of our actions. If you think about human behavior in general, where are the places where you would look at them and you would say, oh, this is where people actually think long-term? It's actually very hard to think about any examples where people think about long-term. Certainly not in eating, certainly not in sexual behavior, certainly not in dieting, certainly not in financial reasoning and saving for retirement, certainly not in health, certainly not in texting and driving. All of those behaviors are things that people just don't think about the cost-benefit analysis. So that's one thing. We just don't think long-term. The other thing is that we're not just interested in the external rewards. Imagine, for example, that you would face a situation in which one of your colleagues left their wallet on their table, and some other people passed by, and you had a chance to steal that wallet, and nobody would ever know that it's you, and nobody would ever catch you, and you would not get punished. Now, you have a lot to gain in this situation, but would you take it? Well, something is holding you back, conscious, some internal judge of what's right and wrong, and the economic model is missing that as well. So on one hand, we don't care about the cost and benefit. On the other hand, we do care about something else, that our internal moral compass that tells us what is okay and what is not okay. The curious thing, though, is this internal moral compass functions in some really bizarre and interesting way that allow us sometimes to behave dishonestly but not alert that internal compass, and therefore feel that we're actually honest, wonderful people.
The other part of the moral compass, for example, in the case of the wallet, is measuring what the rewards will be, not the economic rewards, the personal rewards from returning the wallet and being praised for that.
Yeah, and that's something we really care about. I don't think we do it explicitly, but implicitly we look at ourselves and we want to view ourselves as honest, wonderful people. And we want to do things that are consistent with this model of ourselves. So therefore, if we do something that is out of, you know, social utility or helping somebody else and so on, we do get some internal pleasure out of that. And that's, again, something that we don't necessarily capture in the standard model of dishonesty.
Tell us a little bit about some of the experiments that you did that bore these points out.
Yeah. So first of all, let me describe kind of the basic paradigm, because we first have to come up with a method to measure dishonesty, and then we can start playing with it and seeing what changes it. So the basic study looks as follows. Imagine that you're in a study, you're sitting in a classroom, and you'll be given a sheet of paper with 20 simple math problems. Math problems that everybody could solve if they have enough time, but I don't give you enough time. I say you have 5 minutes, solve as many of those as you can, and I'll pay you $1 per question. You work as fast as you can. At the end of 5 minutes, I say, please stop. Now, count how many questions you got correctly, and now go to the back of the room and shred your piece of paper. And then come to the front of the room and tell me how many questions you got correctly, and I will pay you accordingly. People do this. In the basic experiment, they say they solve 6 problems. We pay them $6. They go home. What the people in the experiment don't know is that we played with the shredder. So the shredder only shreds the sides of the page, but the main body of the page remains intact, and we can jump in and we can figure out how many questions people really solve correctly. And what do we find? People on average solve 4 questions and report 6. And by the way, this average is not driven by a few bad apples. It's driven by lots and lots of people who can cheat a little bit and feel good about themselves. And this is, I think, akin to kind of driving a little bit off the speed limit or adding a few extra receipts to the IRS, tax returns, and so on. So now we have the basic way of measuring dishonesty. And now the question is, what would modulate that? And the story we tell in the book, the story that kind of emerges about dishonesty, is that it's all about rationalization. It's all about the things that we could both rationalize and say to ourselves why they're actually good. And now if you think about this way, you could say, what would influence rationalization? So for example, what would happen if your act of dishonesty was removed from money? Uh-huh. If it was, you didn't have to think to yourself that you're cheating directly, it was more indirect. Maybe like taking pencils from the office rather than taking cash from a petty cash box. So to look at this, we change one thing. In the basic experiment, people come to the experimenter and said, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problems, give me X dollars. And they claim to solve 6. In the new condition, they say, Mr. Experimenter, I solved X problem, give me X tokens. So when they look at the experimenter in the eye, they lie for tokens. Then they take these tokens, they walk 12 feet to the side and change it for dollars. What happened now? Our participant doubled their cheating. Now, this, by the way, is perhaps the most worrisome experiment we've conducted. Because if being one step removed from money for just a few seconds liberates people from the moral shackle to this degree, you can only think about what would happen with things like mortgage-backed securities or stock options or electronic wallets. And could it be that as a society, the more distant we get from money, the easier it is for us to be dishonest. And indeed, that's the finding.
And what do we find in terms of people lying even a little bit about things unrelated to money, lying about sex, about friendship, about whatever it might be?
So in all of those cases, it looks like the results are basically the same. The reality is that there's lots of human values. Honesty is one of them, but there are other ones. For example, saving face or caring about the welfare of other or becoming wealthier. That's another one. And we all know quite well that when these values contradict each other, truth doesn't always win. For example, the standard line of, honey, how do I look in that dress? Right? This is a case where you say to yourself, likely honesty is not the prevailing model here, and we should find something else that is more important, like peace at home or the feeling of somebody else. Now, the tricky thing is that those things, you could argue of whether they're good or not good in the social domain. In the business domain, they become just harmful. Because what is the equivalent of, honey, how do I look in that dress, in terms of expense reports? Or instead of a report that an accountant is creating about the company. If they have a different internal dialogue about the truth and a different dialogue with the outside world about the truth, that's where we get into trouble.
And this is the broader slippery slope argument, that it's a little bit today and a little more tomorrow that's rationalized and a little more the day after that.
Yeah. And when, you know, often when we look at acts of crime, we say to ourselves, we would have never been able to do that. These are just bad people that were doing that. But in my discussions with big, serious criminals, it's almost never the case, actually it was never the case, that anybody planned the whole sequence of events up front. Instead, it was about taking one step, and one small step, and one small step that they could rationalize to themselves. And after they took this one small step, they took another small step, and so on. And because of that, the thing we need to ask ourselves is not whether we should have gone through, you know, 10 years of insider trading or dishonesty or something like that, but whether we would have been able to take the first step. How? And if we were able to take the first step, would we have been able to rationalize it to ourselves? And then would we have found it easier to take the next step and so on? And I think the basic issue is that the separation of good people and bad people. Of course, there's few bad people. But the reality is that there's lots of good people that could dramatically misbehave given the right circumstances. And because of that, we need to think about the circumstances. We need to think about how we ourselves don't get into them, and we need to think about how to prevent other people from getting into these situations.
Talk about the broader cultural construct and what is perceived as acceptable within certain cultures and certain situations as opposed to others. A good example might be bribery, which we look upon one way, for example, here in the United States, and totally differently in terms of the way it's looked at in other countries, for example.
Yeah. So we've done these experiments in many different places around the globe, and we basically find similar results in many places in our experiments, and people don't behave very differently. And the question is, how come? Because we do see these cultural differences in terms of bribery, for example, from place to place. And basically what we find is that the basic human ability to rationalize is kind of the same across the globe. It's about 10, 15, 20% ability to rationalize. We can rationalize a little bit and feel good about ourselves. But what culture does is that cultures give us a signal about what is acceptable and not acceptable, not across the whole moral spectrum, but activity per activity. So, for example, you look even within the U.S., and you talk to young people, and you say to them, how bad would you feel if the New York Times tomorrow had a story saying that they found illegally downloaded music on your computer? And they basically said they couldn't care less, because there's no shame in it. There's no internal compass anymore. You talk to older people about it, they said, oh, this is inappropriate. This is not the right way to go, and they would feel shame. The same thing goes for bribery. Some places, people just feel no shame about bribery. Bribery is just the way things go. This is the way to do business. And in other places, people feel incredibly bad about it. Now, the tricky thing is that this is a deterioration that can happen over time, that if we don't stop it, it's incredibly hard to prevent. So think about what I worry a lot about is plagiarism in schools. What happens if people start, if students start thinking that plagiarizing and copying on test and work in school is okay? Is it going to be a deteriorating slope that is going to be incredibly hard to stop? That by the time it gets to become a social norm and people don't feel bad about it, it will be incredibly difficult to change.
How important is shame in the overall equation? What did you find in that regard?
So shame is basically one of the mechanisms that stops you. It's a fantastic proxy to think about whether this internal mechanism exists or don't exist. I mean, if you take all the different immoral behaviors you could participate in, okay, cheating on your taxes, stealing a book from a friend's house, taking money from a friend's wallet, cheating on an insurance company, downloading illegal material, drinking while driving. Like, you could just take a whole sequence of events. And from each of them, you can ask yourself, how much shame would there be in those if everybody, all your friends found out that you were doing that? And the magnitude of shame is basically the magnitude of the internal compass that is still activating. When there's absolutely no shame, now you're a perfectly rational creature. Now the only thing that would prevent you from doing this is a cost-benefit analysis, is whether you would get caught and how much time will you get in prison. But whenever you have shame, I think there's still hope, because it means that we have this internal compass that can stop us from behaving badly, and we need to think about how we activate it to a higher degree and get people to think more carefully about their actions. And by the way, this is also where the good news of all of this comes from. You know, in general, I think that dishonesty is kind of a depressing topic, because you realize how pervasive it is and how we could all do it and how it's about conflicts of interest and so on. But the good news is that once we remind people about their own morality, about their own values, they stop being dishonest, even if there's no external benefit for that. So, for example, when we ask people to try and recall the Ten Commandments, people stop being dishonest. Even when we take atheists and we ask them to try to swear on the Bible, they stop cheating after that. When we get people to sign an honor code, they stop cheating. I mean, there's all kinds of things about just reminding ourselves who we are and who we want to be that get people to behave more in line with their internal guards.
When people do that cost-benefit analysis, when they try and rationalize, when they put that equation together, to what extent are they deluding themselves in most cases?
Yeah, I think that when we look at the cost-benefit analysis, we think that that's the driver of other people's behavior, but it's not. Look, we had in the last few weeks, we had a few big cases of insider trading. And I've talked to all kinds of insider traders. Nobody I talked to ever thought about the cost-benefit analysis. Nobody thought about the probability of being caught, and nobody thought about time in prison. Now, I think that because in the last few weeks we had quite a few cases, maybe people would be a little bit worried next, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. But after that, I think it would stop. People would stop thinking about those cases. They would think it's irrelevant to them. Instead, if you think about what's happening on the inside the trading floor, the social pressure, the ability to justify it, the ability to say to yourself, everybody else is doing it, or this is just a game. Wall Street in general and banking have so many interesting rationalization working there. I just got an email the other day of somebody who told me that for a long time they were doing things and they were just framing to themselves as a game. They were saying, I'm just competing with other people in a game, not really thinking about the consequences of their actions. And that, of course, allowed them to do all kinds of misbehaviors. So I think, when we as regulators or individuals think about the cost-benefit analysis, this is kind of the trivial model of dishonesty, and that's what we're doing to try and prevent it. But is it really working? I think the evidence is quite clear. In fact, California is an interesting case because the three strikes and you're out didn't seem to do much, right? All of a sudden, tremendous cost for committing a third crime, and it doesn't seem to cause much. And more, even worse, there's a recent study by the National Academy of Sciences that looked at the death penalty. And they said, is there evidence that states that have the death penalty have a lower crime rate in terms of crimes that you could get the death penalty for? And they couldn't find any evidence for that. Now, the studies are really difficult. It's hard to compare. There are different states and so on. But the fact that the death penalty, the hardest, kind of more severe penalty we could come up with, has no observable effect on crime suggests to me that this model of thinking long term is just not relevant here.
Of course, the overlay to all of this, which we see so much in the political realm, but it exists even in the most petty crime, where the cover-up itself becomes worse than the crime. The lies escalate, as you alluded to before.
Yeah, and this is not something we could do in our experiments because if we don't catch people and so on. But in my discussions with serious criminals, that's often the case, that they start on a slippery slope, they start with one step, they say, I'll only do it for one quarter or just for this report, and then after a while, they just get sucked into it. And at some point, they realize it's very bad, but they don't have a way out. And actually, in our experiments, we do find evidence for the slippery slope, and while we don't catch people, one of the things we've tried is to give people the chance to confess. So we use kind of something similar to the Catholic confession, where people say what they've done badly and they can ask for forgiveness. We don't grant them forgiveness and we don't charge them for this. But, they basically just say what they've done badly and ask for forgiveness. And what we see is that this ability basically gets them to start a new page and they stop cheating. They start fresh. And I think similar mechanisms could be implemented in society as well. Once somebody cheats in an egregious way, I think many times at some point they catch themselves, they realize it, but at that point it's too late. And then they just continue and continue and continue until the financial devastation and the devastation in general is much, much higher. And I think this is one of the cases where religious kind of got it right, both Judaism and Christianity have this notion of confession, And I think atonement and opening a new page. And I think if we just try to implement it more in civic society, we would be better off.
In a broader civic sense, the whole idea that we've seen in certain horrible cases of sort of truth and reconciliation accomplishes a similar kind of thing.
Yeah. The South African approach of the Truth and Reconciliation Act, I think, has been a great example, and I've talked to some people in South Africa, and they are now exporting that model to other countries as well. You know, sadly, there's no shortage of countries that had civic unrest and bloody conflicts between them. And the question is, how do you stop something like this? And I think something like the Reconciliation Act, when you stop, you say what you've done badly, and you try to start a new page, is incredibly important.
Dan Ariely, the book is The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Dan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you again. Take care.
Thank you.